Session number 13265, reel number 7.
Mr. Marsden, reel 7.
And he'd also signed out to himself a fitter's bench, laughingly so called a mobile bench. This was a steel effort, not very large, about 18 inches square, and with two small cast iron wheels, and had a vice mount, an engineer's vice mounted on it. It was not very stable, but it could, with care, be taken out onto the flights, onto the field, and be used instead of having to go to a permanent bench in a workshop. As I say, it was not very stable. There was not enough size about the base of it, but it was very heavy. And Boyd would take this German ammunition and pyrotechnics or whatever, put them in the vice, and dismantle them by fair means or foul. If he could dismantle them properly and examine the interiors, I gather he made notes and so on and reported on their contents. If he couldn't get them apart, then he simply took a hacksaw to them. And I don't know whether Mr. Peter Parrott mentioned this in his reminiscences. On one occasion, Boyd was merrily sawing away at a piece of this material gripped in the vice. Gives me the shudders to think of it, gripping it in the vice, let alone anything else, when the thing started smoking. Oh, what does Adrian Boyd say to Peter Parrott? Get the kettle over here and you pour water on it while I carry on sawing.
Gives you he didn't mention that.
Oh, gives you the shudders, doesn't it? And that went on quite a lot. At about the same time, Adrian decided that if there was going to be an invasion, we all ought to be able to defend ourselves. Well, we ground crew, about this time, had been issued with the Ross rifles, which I understand were brought across from Canada on those flush deck destroyers which we borrowed from the Americans, Campbelltown type. These rifles had been packed in grease, I forget the American name for that type of grease, in 1918 or 19 at the end of the First War, and had never been used since, so that they were fairly solid. And we were given a rifle each and told to clean them and make them serviceable. We were given nothing to clean them with, so we had to scrounge up all the rags we could find and get buckets of petrol and just pull them apart as best we could and dump them in the petrol and then get them into a usable state. We were not too happy with them because most of us rather liked the Lee Enfield, and towards the Ross was didn't seem as good a job. I'm not sure whether they were 30 caliber or 303s. They had the pinhole backsight, as I recall, and we'd had firing steps made up on the aircraft blast bays. They were not E type bays at this stage. Shelter bays, of which we only had a few for the aircraft, were a rectangular C type, and we had a firing step on the inside so that we could stand and poke our heads over the top and look towards Bognor, where it was assumed any local invasion would occur. Relevant to this, the station's Bofors guns had all been mounted on truncated pyramids of earth reveted with sandbags, so that the Bofors guns could be dropped down to fire at a low angle across the fields towards Bognor and give them an increased field of fire. And as I said, at this time Adrian Boyd decided we would have to be able to defend ourselves. We had that, We had one of the German swivel type hand operated machine guns mounted with a G-clamp onto a fence post so that we could carry the whole thing on its fence post and drop it in a hole in the ground. And the rule was whoever got first to it fired it, but when Boyd E arrived, it was his. that was our total anti-aircraft defences. Anyway, Boyd decided that the Veery pistol offered an interesting way into defence, and so he opened up some Veery cartridges and proceeded to load them with nails and other interesting chunks of old iron. And having done this, decided that he would test fire it, this gun, at the door of the old mill, which stood nearby on the aircraft perimeter. There was the bottom end of the tower of an old windmill nearby. And he fired this thing at the door and blew a dirty great hole in the door and nearly broke his wrist, after which he decided that it perhaps wasn't a good idea after all. Round about this time then we were moved to West Hamnet, which is now Goodwood Aerodrome. We were moved there and we found that there was no provision for us at all.
This is July 1940, by the way.
Yes, middle July. The dining room was the wagon shed of the farm, with some rough tables placed underneath it, and that dining room was for aircrew, everyone alike. It was quite an interesting dining room, because there were swallows and all sorts of birds in the rafters above, and stuff fell down from the rafters onto the tables, spiders, everything, into the food. It was quite interesting, that was, to see some people jiggling their plates about, trying to avoid getting unwanted additions. What were supposed to be our billets were brick huts with corrugated asbestos roofs, windows in either end and doors in either end. The windows were glazed, and the first thing we had to do with them was paint them black for the blackout, which made you wonder why they bothered putting windows in. The power was not on, but it didn't make any difference yet, because there were no fittings on the end of the wires and there were no bulbs anyway. And the concrete floors were still wet. They were set, you could just walk on them, but they were thoroughly wet. And there were no beds, there were no bedboards. There was no anything. The wash place was the existing farm trough in the field, and two boards had been laid across it, and some ultra-modern plumbing had been added to it, so that there was a gallery pipe running across it from the existing water supply. A T-piece had been put in just before the ball cock for the trough, and a gallery pipe taken from it with six taps branching off it, and six zinc bowls resting on the two boards across the trough. That was the washing facilities for the squadron. And we were told to get on with it, just like that. Well, we all of us at that time had ground sheets or capes. I don't mean not the gas capes, but we most of us had the old-fashioned Macintosh, a rubberized cape, which was a ground sheet. It gave a rectangle of waterproof material on, rubberized cotton, whatever, about 6 foot by 3 foot, with an extension flap on at one end, so that when the when you put the thing on, you get an extremely good cape, but rather heavy and very sweaty, a heavy thing to wear, but quite a good ground sheet. So the chaps who had no great imagination put the ground sheets down on the wet concrete and their blankets on there, and made their bed up using gas mask cases and one thing or another as pillows, and proceeded to get on with it. One or two of us decided that we could do better than that, because you get an awful lot of sweating, whether on grass or anything else, with those with a ground sheet, and you tend to get a lot of wetness about, and your blankets get wet and so on. So we looked in the hedge and we pulled out some of the long fence bars and scrounged around, and we got ourselves some bricks. These huts had recently been built. There was plenty of sand and bricks about. There were some air raid shelters to be done. And, I got six bricks and a couple of lengths of timber out of the hedge, hard lines on the farmer and the hedge, and I got a hurricane rigging mat. Rigging mats were used on fabric-covered aircraft. And the early hurricanes had fabric-covered wings. They were steel structures with a metal D nose to them, but the rear half of the wing was fabric-covered. And we'd had none initially because they'd gone out of service, but we still had the rigging mats. Rigging mats are about 9 feet long, and they're made rather like a tambour shutter. They're about 30 inches wide, of slats about an inch by half an inch, with bevelled or rounded edges, and the slats are mounted on heavy tape, and they're backed with a thick felt, so that when they're laid on a fabric-covered wing, you can walk on the mat without damaging either the fabric-covered wing, the ribs of the aircraft, or the finish. But if you lay them out the other way and then roll up the excess length as a kind of pillow, you have a bed mattress covered with 3/8 of an inch of felt. See, well, two or three of us thought this was rather a nifty idea, and we whipped into the flight store tent and whipped these away. And we were quite comfortable, thanks. Until Chiefy found out. We got a few days out of it, by which time there was the beginning of beds appearing, so it wasn't too bad. But when Chiefy found out, we got a rocket and they had to go back in case they were needed. And gradually we began to get things shaped up. There were huge pits being excavated for air raid shelters, so that the pioneers who were doing this work had dug rectangular holes quite near to our huts, which were of the order of 8 or 9 feet deep, about 12 feet across and 20, 30 feet long. And they come back into the story in just a little while. Well, then things really began to get hot, and as of that date, it seemed that 145 Squadron were the first squadron we fired the opening shots of what was then dated as the Battle of Britain. The goalposts were moved later, but at that stage, I think it was August the 8th or thereabouts, the attacks on the Peewit convoy off the south coast were reckoned to be amongst, I think, the opening bars of the battle, and our squadron was heavily involved in that, and we had Friday, a and then I think Monday and so on, quite a lot of flying. And that was where the turnaround times that we had managed to achieve became quite important, as our kites took off and operated against the Stukas and so on, came back, and we sent bashed them out again and got them, you know, got things going pretty well. And on the first day of that battle, 145, I think, claimed 21 aircraft down, and Archibald Sinclair must have believed it because he gave us a day off and came down to see the squadron and pat us on the back and say how good we all were, or pat us on the head, I don't know. We also began to lose pilots too. But as a result of being apparently getting this excellent score and getting the day off, Boydie decided that there should be a flight binge. I think Boydie used to hark back to the First War and the way fighter squadron carried on a little bit. I suspect he was slightly romantic as well. And so the pilots got in some crates of beer and so on, and we were all invited into the pilots' hut, and the phrase in those days was to have a session, beer drinking and whatnot, and yarning and one thing or other. And so we all sat round, and I won't say that ranks went by the board, they never do exactly, but there was a good deal of freedom, and everything was quite pleasant. And then one of our corporals, a Welshman, I can't remember his name, being Welsh he was naturally called Taffy, he decided that he had to go out to look at the moon, and in the course of doing so he fell into the excavation. Nobody noticed his absence for a little while until we heard this sort of eldritch wailing from somewhere we couldn't understand where, because it seemed to be in the distance, and we couldn't see anyone, and then of course we realised that he was in this great pit, standing in the bottom wailing to be lifted out, because he couldn't get out, he couldn't reach the top. And by this stage of the game, I suppose it was 10 or 11 o'clock at night or thereabouts, quite a few of the fellows who drank at all had a drink taken. I was never much of a drinker anyway, so I'd had probably two shanders or something like that, and I was content, very content, to sit by and watch all this. And being an observer is a lot more fun. And so Chiefy Bannister, who had well of drink taken, and a couple more, decided they would go and help him. So they jumped in to help him out. which meant, of course, that we were all standing on the top watching them, and not having the slightest intention of doing anything about it. So they were all stuck down in there until the following morning, and they were left overnight. And Chiefy wasn't too happy when we finally got him out the following morning. In fact, he was downright disgruntled. But, just one of those little things. Things were a bit quiet over the weekend, and then things started up again on the Monday. It's only of late years, when I've done any research, that I discovered that to some extent the Luftwaffe was still operating in the same way that the RAF had operated up to this time. Weekends were for off. And have you come across this? You'll notice.
No.
If you check into 1940, you'll find out that quite often Saturdays and Sundays operations went by the board. It was weekend. You know, the phony war was still holding sway to some extent. Anyway, whether it was weather or whether it was the hammering they'd had or whatever, things were a bit quiet over the weekend, but they started up again on the Monday. And by the Tuesday, we were down to about four or five aircraft in the flight and three pilots, or four or five pilots and three aircraft, I can't remember which. But the squadron had had a real good dusting. We lost, I think over that week, over that weekend, we lost 11 pilots out of 20, 25, something of that order. And we were pulled out on rest to go to Drem. Well, a couple of Sparrows came in to take the advance party up there, so that we ground crew, who were going as advance party, you know, covering selection of trades, so that the when the aircraft got up to Drem, we'd be able to operate the aircraft, if not be operational as a squadron. We got all our kit together and our toolboxes and so on, and we sat by the Harrows. You know about Sparrows.
Are they vehicles?
The Sparrows were Handley Page Harrows, which were initially bomber transports, but were now solely transport aircraft, and they became known as Sparrows. I forget the name, the number of the squadron which operated them, but they were based on Doncaster. I'm not going to say that it was 23 Squadron definitely, but I could find out in a matter of minutes. But anyway,
there was some kind of transport.
A high-wing twin-engined aircraft, and we were loaded in. We sat by them, waiting for clearance from the control tower in Tangmere before we could take off to get off up to Drem. We couldn't go because there were too many enemy aircraft hurtling about. While we were sitting waiting, there were Hurricanes chasing Messerschmitts over the field and so on. Johnny Peel had come back and had bodged his landing up, or shot down or whatever. His Hurricane was standing on its nose at the top of the field. It was the kind of sight one would expect to see, although rarely did. In, you know, under those conditions, Adrian Boyd's aircraft, one of them, K, I think that was still up the field on its nose. I'll go back to that story in a minute, as I should. And so we're sitting waiting to go up to Drem. Going back to Adrian Boyd, I may have confused things. It may not have been there at this time. It may have been a day or two earlier. The mind slips a gear occasionally after 50 years. What happened was that the flight had been scrambled, and Boyd had followed his orders, and I think was trying to intercept an enemy aircraft, which turned out to be a Dornier 17, 217, something of that order, the Dornier twin engine job, fairly high, and was climbing to intercept this, and was just about in firing range, climbing towards it, when a Spit popped out of a cloud, spotted the Dornier, opened fire immediately, and put five rounds into Boyd's Hurricane. And it's one of those cockeyed things. You know, five rounds, and you think, well, a Hurricane could take five rounds, no bother. Except, the first round hit the PESCO pump on the front starboard side of the engine, the vacuum pump, so that he lost his instruments. The second round hit the compound oil relief valve on the side of the engine, so that he lost all his oil pressure and lost all his oil for the engine. The third round hit the BTH air compressor, so he lost all his oil air pressure, so he lost his guns. The fourth round hit the glycol header tank, so he lost his coolant. So now he's in the stage where he has no vacuum pressure for his instruments. He has no oil, no oil pressure for his engine, which is rapidly getting warm and running out of urge, but he's lost his coolant anyway, so that he can't cool it, and his engine is going to seize up any time at all. And the fifth round clipped the back of his neck without touching his neck, took the buckle off his goggles, and his goggles flew away, and he's now in an aircraft which is spewing oil and glycol and everything else, and he has no goggles. And, of course, he has to have the hatchback. That round, incidentally, had gone through the hatch, through his nice blister, and shattered the perspex, so that his nice one-off hatch has gone for a burn. And now he's having to sit in an aircraft where he's got the cockpit open. He's getting a face full of oil and glycol and stuff of that order coming back on him. And the engine is getting ready to seize, and he's about 10, 15 miles out towards the sea, over the sea. So he has to head back to West Hampton as smartly as he can on a Merlin, which is beginning to cough and chunter a bit. So that by the time he swings round and comes in to make an approach, the engine is only just kicking over, and I'm working at the northeast corner of West Hampton. I was working on another aircraft. We were changing an air compressor on it when I see this hurricane coming into view on a road which is parallel with the northern edge of the West Hampton field. I saw that it was Kay, and I realised what was happening, because Boyd had always laid down the law that any aircraft which came back, which was damaged, which could not make a normal landing and taxi in, if it had to belly in, the pilot was to put it down alongside the edge of the field, whichever edge didn't matter, but along the edge of the field, so that it didn't render the airfield US for the other aircraft. And here's Boyd coming in, and the props just kicking over, there's black smoke coming from it, there's white smoke coming from it, from the coolant and whatnot. The hatch is back, he's got his flaps down, his undercart up, and he's obviously going to make a belly landing along the top edge of the flight line. Well, I bellowed at the meat wagon types and the crash wagon, "Get yourself moving, look what's happening." And they sat and looked at me. So I began to curse them most heartily and explain to them in fairly short Anglo-Saxon terms that here's an aircraft coming in, he's going to make a belly landing, and it may catch fire immediately, and they ought to be there, not waiting for him to do it. They ought to be getting along there. So they did that, eventually, chasing after him. Boyd put the thing down, and travelling that way, and as it came to a stop, it slewed, so that it's facing towards the hedge. And he bounded out, "My first crash! My first crash! Screwdriver!" Grabbed a screwdriver off one of the bods and jumped back into it to get the clock for a souvenir. End of that story. As I say, so now we come along to the Tuesday following the convoy battle, and we fly up to Drem, and this was my first flight, so I was quite interested to see what flying was like. As we took off, it was a glorious sunny day, and I can see it even now, as we took off and climbed away, there was a target towing Blackburn Shark taking off, I think, from Thorny Island, which was a coastal command station. Took off from Thorny Island,